Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to This Is Revolution Podcast. If you are a returning listener or subscriber, thank you very much for coming back. Appreciate you guys. If you are new to this channel, welcome. If you do dig what we do here on your way out, make sure to give the show a like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. I will be alone tonight in the main show as Toussaint and Pascal are getting ready for the BBP, the big black panel that we're doing Saturday morning. I don't even want to name all the names. It's so heavy, I can't even name it. It won't even come out of my mouth. The BBP. Zing. But in the champagne room, I will be joined later with Soviet scholar Alexander Herbert, where we will be dissecting liberal videos about the Soviet Union. There's anything that really gets under the skin of Dr. Alexander Herbert is, literal depictions of the Soviet Union. He said, and I quote, in a voice message earlier today, "Jason, you're unleashing a beast. Just want you to know that." So in the champagne room tonight, Alexander will be unleashing the beast on liberals and their depictions of the Soviet Union. But today, in this first hour, we're going to talk about the rise and or the fall and the rise of finance in America. How often have we heard that we are witnessing the failures of neoliberal capitalism? Capitalism itself is in its latter stages. For some reason, people seeing a certain amount of visual decay in services in the environment believe that these are signals that we are in the death throes of capitalism. Financialization has gone too far, and the system is in its last days. But is that really the case? From the book, The Fall and Rise of American Finance. By tracing the emergence of financial capital, we show that far from being a feature of a supposedly late stage of capitalism, finance was in fact central to the early development and dynamism of American capitalism. Nor could finance be thought of as parasitic. The amassing of vast pools of money capital in the banks, along with their ability to generate credit, allowed banks to organize accumulation on a massive scale by merging isolated enterprises into giant industrial firms. But these bank-controlled firms were not monopolies. Instead, the emergence of the corporate form and the development of the financial system reduced transaction costs and increased capital mobility, intensifying competitive pressures. The result was the integration of a highly regionalized American economy into a national economy dominated by investment banks and the corporations they owned and controlled. Again, that quote is from the book we'll be discussing tonight, The Fall and Rise of American Finance. Wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there are links in the description to the book so you can read it for yourself. Our guests today, Steve Mayer and Scott Aquino. Steve is the assistant professor of economics at SUNY Cortland and associate editor of the Socialist Register. He is also the author of Corporate Capitalism and the Integral State, General Electric, and A Century of American Power, while Scott Aquino is assistant professor of political science at Ontario Tech University and a visiting associate at the Global Labor Research Center at York University. He is the author of Crisis of Risk, Subprime Debt, and U.S. Financial Power from 1944 to present. Please welcome our guests, Scott and Steve. Bam, bam.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate the very real applause. That's very, feels good.
Right? There's nothing worse than when you do something like this and it's just quiet and it's all NPR-ish.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is NPR for people that still day drink.
Absolutely.
Didn't know we were going to start off with a zinger. So one of the...
We can just go now. That's fine.
Okay, well, this is why I can't get a job on radio. One of the key themes in the book is the concept of financialization and its implications for the economy. Actually, before I even ask the question, I do want to pull back a little bit and say thank you guys for coming on. And also, I'm not done with the book yet. You can yell at me if you want to, Steve, but I've been really busy. And I haven't had a chance to read all 279 pages. But what I'm reading is one of those books that you're learning. For me, you're learning on every page. It is easy to digest. It's not filled with big words and hard terminology. So even if you don't understand finance, these two guys lay it out very, very easy for you. But back to the first talking point. One of the key themes in the book is the concept of financialization and its implications for the economy. Could you explain for everybody what financialization is and how it has led to the prioritization of short-term profit-seeking over long-term economic stability and social well-being?
Scott, do you mind if I take
it? Yeah, jump in, Steve.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think financialization is a very general term. And kind of one of the points we make in the book is that there are different forms of financialization that emerge at different times. And so you can kind of trace the history of capitalist development in the United States by dividing it into different periods in which you have different forms of kind of class hegemony. So we start off with the classical finance capital period in which investment banks kind of initially played the leading role in organizing the giant multinational, later multinational, but at that time, just giant national corporations. Mm-hmm. And that lasted until 1929, clearly a form of financialization in the sense that finance was empowered, right? Relative to industrial capital, finance was the more powerful fraction of the capitalist class. That collapsed in 1929 with the Great Depression, the stock market crash of 29. And through the New Deal, a form of industrial capitalist hegemony emerged, which we call managerialism, in which the industrial corporation was the dominant economic force in society. But within the structure of managerial capitalism dominated by industrial corporations, a new form of financialization kind of emerged within the non-financial corporation, whereby basically the non-financial corporation gradually became a financial institution. And as the managers of those corporations basically became investors. They evolved over the post-war decades into being investors, just allocating money capital, allocating investment across the different kind of competing business divisions that the corporations controlled. So they were diversified firms. And the main decision that these guys were facing were where to send the investment, which part of the corporation. And they were doing that based on competitive criteria. So the corporation kind of became a portfolio of competing financial assets, each vying for investment from the top managers who basically became money capitalists. So that was, again, financialization in the sense that the logic of finance, you know, what Marx called money capital, that is to say money just becoming more money, was the kind of dominant logic, became the dominant logic within the firm. And then we all know, you know, the neoliberal period of financialization in which the financial sector became, you know, across the entire economy, the kind of leading force politically and economically. And then we argue after 2008, a new form of financialization emerged that was as the giant asset management companies, BlackRock, State Street, and BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, what are often called the big three, replaced the banks as the dominant institutions in the contemporary financial system and amassed ownership holdings in every major firm, an average of 20% holdings across all the largest firms.
That's
unprecedented in the history of capitalism.
Does it help that after the crash, they're kind of buying up all this debt for pennies on the dollar from the state? Is that part of their growth? Because how big are they before the crash?
Go ahead, Scott. I'll let you.
Wonder Twins.
Yeah.
It is definitely the case that the crisis and the interventions that were made during the crisis, particularly quantitative easing in its various iterations, led to the remarkable expansion of these, you know, passive asset management firms. Passive in the sense that they're not actively managing their portfolio of investments by selecting this stock or selecting that stock, mm-hmm. but actually just kind of following an underlying index and buying and selling based on what's happening in that underlying index, right? Mm-hmm. So the rise of this passive form of asset management was definitely a function of the interventions of the 2008 financial crisis. BlackRock was, of course, a player in the financial system prior to 2008. The book in the final two chapters traces the rise of BlackRock from the 2000s onward. Mm-hmm. Vanguard has a longer history, and then State Street as well has a pre-2008 history. But these aren't major players in the financial system prior to 2008. And it's really the government's intervention into financial markets and the government's purchase of mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds through quantitative easing that set off a chain reaction that led to the rise of these asset management firms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just very briefly, when the government purchased mortgage-backed securities and, you know, treasury debt to save and to rescue the financial system, mm-hmm. The 2008 financial system, what essentially this did is lead other financial firms to purchase less or more risky forms of debt because they were selling their good treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities to the state. Is they purchase corporate bonds, they push other institutions to run into other forms of financial investment. All of these financiers were, of course, you know, searching for capital and searching for return. So the basic effect of quantitative easing was to set off a chain reaction through the financial system mm-hmm. that essentially de-risked equity as well as corporate bonds as well. And as equity was de-risked, and as equity prices, you know, generally increased across the board, the asset management firms, right, which manage these passive index funds, received an enormous boost because a rising tide lifts all. Their investment strategy in the context of generalized asset inflation, especially equity inflation, became much more profitable, much more desirable, I should say, than the kind of active management strategies that were run by other asset management firms. Just to get, you know, back to the point again, it was in fact the interventions of 2008 that stimulated the move into passive management and the massive concentration of equity holdings that BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street have obtained.
Did you want to add anything there, Steve?
No, I think Scott covered it pretty well. Yeah.
I mean, now I can tell who wrote what.
You think so? You think so? Actually, you'd be surprised that this book is it's a marvel of technology. AI wrote the whole thing.
You just plugged it in.
Go.
Neoliberalist plunder over the.
Yeah, no, but actually, in reality, the writing process was pretty weird. We literally co-wrote every single word. Like, we were on Google Docs. Scott was in Ontario and I was in BC at the time. And we were both on looking at the same Google Doc and talking to each other on FaceTime audio for, you know, from literally 9 a.m. until 4 p.m., 5 days a week for 2 years.
And we co-wrote
every single word, literally.
Two-year endeavor. And then editors came in and said, nope.
Exactly.
You thought that was cute? Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. That's when the real AI came in.
I know the feeling. You two have astutely critiqued the neoliberal policies that have facilitated the rise of finance at the expense of social welfare and economic stability. What are some specific examples of these policies, and how would you guys say they've harmed marginalized communities?
So, yeah, I mean, the way that I would think of neoliberalism and neoliberal policy would, I guess, be two different things. First of all, I think globalization would be the central thing. Globalization being about promoting the mobility of capital internationally across borders so that capital can basically circulate anywhere in the planet with zero cost. And the effect of that was to tremendously intensify competitiveness, right? Disciplined workers to, as they competed for jobs, and it disciplined states as they competed for investment from US MNCs and other MNCs internationally. And so the reason why, you know, this is significant for our argument is because, you know, one of the things we're trying to take on, as you kind of suggested in your introductory comments, is this idea that you have a kind of phase of monopoly capital now, where, you know, big corporations are basically doing economic planning, and they're essentially mini command economies that are, you know, not meaningfully competing, after the competitive phase of capitalism that supposedly was long ago has faded away. And what we basically say is that the development of the large corporation and eventually the multinational corporation really intensified the mobility of capital, intensified the competitiveness of capital, because as investment is circulating freely, all possible outlets for investment face the discipline of either maximizing the returns to the investors or facing the withdrawal of investment. So competition is then all about capital mobility, right? It's about the extent to which capital can move freely across space and across sectors. And so the multinational corporation, given that it is the most mobile, the most able to invest in things that are profitable and restructure and divest from things that are not profitable, the large corporation is actually the most competitive. And you see this in terms of first the formation of a national economy, and then ultimately the global economy in the neoliberal period. So the financial system and the large corporation have tremendously intensified the competitiveness of capital. And that's really what neoliberalism is about above all. And the effect of that has been to tremendously accelerate class discipline, class discipline, and to discipline states to enact the regulatory and other policies that capital finds most suitable.
Yeah, and wrapped up with globalization then is the rise of independent central banks, as you have, you know, the removal of capital controls and the privatization of currency markets and floating currency rates, etc., all of which, you know, kind of our critical infrastructure for a globalizing form of capital. You have the rise of independent central banks. The Federal Reserve takes a new prominent place within the hierarchy of institutions within the American state. And one of the things, of course, the Federal Reserve does is reinforce class discipline through maintaining high levels of unemployment and low levels of inflation. And we see this politics, of course, still here today. Mm-hmm. So a defining characteristic of the neoliberal period, in good part because of the point that its orientation around globalized production, etc., is, you know, a central bank which is at the head of state power and which is managing growth by maintaining low levels of interest, low levels of inflation, often through high levels of interest, especially in the 80s and 90s, right? And the effect of this, of course, is very significant because through high interest rates and the dominance of monetary policy over fiscal policy, you have underemployment and unemployment and precarious employment, which maintains and reinforces class discipline and, of course, is very beneficial in terms of corporate profitability.
You guys also talk about kind of the hollowing out of labor unions in your work as well. Do you think that really ramps up in the 80s or before that in the 70s and late 60s?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the emergence of business unionism, you know, certainly you see that, you know, as coming about in the kind of post-war period. I mean, other than the immediate post-war strike wave, you kind of do see the general de-radicalization of the trade unions in the United States. And, you know, ultimately leading to the tragedy, really, that is the crisis of the 1970s, tragedy for labor, in the sense that labor was at the peak of its power in the 1970s when the profit squeeze crisis was happening, right? The productivity, the regular productivity growth that had supported the ability for both wages and profits to rise throughout the so-called golden age of capitalism from the 1940s until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. That productivity growth slowed down. And that meant that the continued wage militancy of the trade unions squeezed profits, leading to the stagflation crisis ultimately. And so it was ironically the fact that trade unions had accepted the capitalist the capitalist mode of production as the extent of their political horizons that led trade unions to basically see no alternative but to accept the neoliberal restructuring of the 1970s and 1980s on the hopes that eventually things would go back to normal and the boom conditions of the post-war period would return, rather than say, if it's a choice between the hard-fought gains of the working class or capitalism, we should choose to keep the hard-fought gains of the working class and get rid of capitalism, start thinking about moving towards gaining public control over investment, right, rather than having it be controlled by private financiers. But alas, the trade unions were so thoroughly depoliticized at that point, there was no such demand that was on the agenda. And so you really saw the limits of the kind of model of wage militancy in the 1970s crisis and the ultimate rollback and defeat of the trade union movement. That was a result both of the aggressive attacks from the state, but also the limited vision and imagination of the trade union, of the politics of trade unions themselves.
And this all culminates in, you know, a globalized financial system of accumulation, which starts to develop in the late 1970s and early 1980s. So globalization and financialization then become, you know, solutions for capital to the profitability crisis of the 1970s. And, you know, the struggles for the development of this new system of accumulation, of course, have to be understood in terms of the productivist model of trade union business organization that had developed in the post-war period, as Steve mentioned.
Here we are in 2024. Everyone loves talking about a bit of a labor uprising that we're seeing. Especially when it comes to the service sector, which is kind of where the working class is, right? Do you guys find a little bit of hope in that? Because it seems like the service sector, and granted, it's still the Starbucks unions and things like that, are quite powerless, right? But do you think there is a politicization of the unions, or is it still just smoke and mirrors and a lot of people excited about Starbucks?
I mean, I think we're starting to see perhaps a kind of turn toward an orientation toward class struggle unionism. You see people like Sarah Nelson, you know, and so there is a kind of perceptible turn toward a class struggle or social justice unionism. But I think the challenge right now, and this we don't really get into this in the book, but I think the challenge right now is really to get beyond kind of isolated rebellions and defensive struggles and find a way to connect this in a class way, in a broader way. And I think in terms of what you suggest about the service sector being where the working class is at, I think that's true. But I also think really the white whale of contemporary labor struggles, I'm not sure it's the right metaphor, but I'm going to go with it anyway, is Amazon. You know, it's Amazon. I think that's
for you.
I think that is where you know, that's where the workers are. You want to talk about big facilities where thousands of workers are working together in incredibly alienating conditions. Amazon.
Look, I'm with you. Before we parted ways with Zero Books, I made a video essay for Zero Books. I think the title was like, you know, Nomadland is a neoliberal whitewashing of something. I can't remember. But that movie, Oscar-winning movie, sets Amazon as kind of the employer of record. There's literally a person in that movie that has a repetitive hand injury in real life, because there was real people in that movie. And they're playing a role that they literally can't do in real life using that machine. As much as we can talk about how much we hate Amazon, are we addicted to the just-in-time financial model enough for us to try to be militant? I mean, if you guys don't want to answer this, I understand. I'll look, I was excited about Chris Smalls. He was a guest on the show when I started 5 years ago. What happened to all that energy around that moment? It felt like, oh, we could just make you famous.
Yeah, I think the ALU is a tough case, and I think, you know, I think having one recognition and then kind of not continued organizing. I think there was a lot of problems with the Staten Island model. I'm not sure. I'm not here to trash the ALU, but I think that there's other approaches that could be perhaps more effective. And I think there was some mistakes made that ultimately, you know, made things turn out the way that they did. And now you see, you know, the other challenges coming from, you know, bigger unions like the Teamsters, you know, thinking they're going to come in and organize Amazon, and maybe they will have some successes. But you know, that comes with its own challenges, because obviously the Teamsters are not known for being, you know, bastions of progressive politics, whatever the leadership might have changed. And so, you know, it doesn't exactly, you know, there's going to be other challenges that emerge from that. But I think that in terms of, you know, looking at Starbucks, it's an important victory, but it's what, I forget the number. It's a couple isolated facilities,
yeah,
you know, spread across the entire country. You know, Amazon is more significant to me because you're talking about large numbers of workers, especially in the fulfillment centers, you know, working shoulder to shoulder in the kinds of conditions you read about in Capital Volume One, which, you know, should be and facing grievances that, you know, should be able to be the basis for broader organizing. And something like Amazon would mean something from a class perspective, right? It would actually transform the class, depending on how it's organized and how the struggle plays out after that. But
it feels, again, I wasn't alive in the 20s, 30s. You know, I wish I could have been around for the Pullman Porter, you know, organization. But with Amazon, it feels like almost too big to organize. They're usually, especially in depressed economic areas, the employer of record. And what I mean by that, they're going to pay some really high wages, where you could probably maybe not buy a house, but at least afford to live somewhat comfortably. It seems like it's almost impossible to organize. I mean, anything can be organized, but. Yeah. What are we missing strategically? I know you guys don't write about this in your book, but now we're on this Amazon roll. Because I agree with you. I agree with both of you. I think this is logistics. We saw it with UPS.
Yeah.
Right? How quick, yeah, people, oh, hey, we don't want to shut down UPS. We definitely don't want to shut down the cheap shit that we get from Amazon. We rely on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, I think that the challenges with Amazon are not just the size, although the size is a part of it, but you know, there's a very high rate of turnover among the workforce. You know, there's extremely tight discipline over what workers do and when they do it, when they're at work, who they talk to, how long they can spend talking to each other, where they can go. Mm-hmm. The time management, you know, like Mark says in Volume One, moments are the elements of profit. I mean, that really, you could see that in Amazon. And so there's a tremendous, the rate of turnover alone makes it a huge challenge. But, you know, I think it's doable. I think, you know, if you look at the CIO organizing in the 30s, there's obviously very different situation, but also a lot of similarities and some similar challenges. So I think it is doable. I feel like it's possible, and the opportunity's there. I just think, you know, it's obviously not going to be easy.
Scott.
Yeah, I think, and you know, one of the other issues that compounds the difficulty, and I completely agree with what Steve just said, is that Amazon itself is incredibly financialized. You know, Steve and I were talking today and looking at Amazon's, you know, vast list of first-party suppliers. And you realize really, really quickly that this is an institution that has subcontracting relationships with, you know, hundreds, you know, nearly thousands of firms, mostly located in the global south, to carry out, you know, various forms of production that they see fit based on, you know, the sales process on their website. And so that, of course, raises another range of challenges, this financialized kind of, you know, model of investment. But you know, as Steve just mentioned, you know, there is, I think, an opportunity despite its size, to organize. And I think that should certainly be, you know, one of the focal points of the labor movement because of its central place within retail, within merchant capital, in the circuit of accumulation more generally. Right.
I mean, yeah, I'm with you guys. We do have a super chat question that I will save for the end of the show. Don't look.
Okay.
Don't look. Scott, I already see you looking. You can't look. In the book, you take on the unfinished business of Marx's third volume of Capital to explain the creation of the modern banking industry, and the industrial corporations are the beginnings of finance capital. Can you explain a bit for our audience? And can you explain kind of the difference between industrial capital and finance capital, which you guys explained very well in the book?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So, I mean, I think what's interesting about this question is that, you know, typically speaking, you see this history framed as, including within, you know, mainstream economics and Keynesian economics, you see this history framed as there was first a phase of competitive capitalism. That's the Garden of Eden of capitalism, the ancient past, right? The primordial moment of capitalism. And it was apparently perfect competition, which was gradually overtaken by a more and more monopolistic and less competitive form of capitalism. But actually, if you look at the history, it's pretty close to the opposite. Early capitalism in the American case, you know, pre-mid 19th century, was highly regionalized, highly fragmented. There was extremely high transaction costs. It was very expensive to move stuff around. There was no real national financial system to speak of. And because of that, the fragmentation of the internal market, it was extremely easy to develop regional monopolies. Competitive disciplines were comparatively weak. The development of a national banking system and eventually the investment banking system that was centered around people like J.P. Morgan made possible the development of the giant corporation. So you have a financial system operating on a national scale. You have corporate businesses operating on a national scale. And as this is all happening, the financial system is being elaborated. Production is taking place on a larger and larger scale. The forces of competition are becoming amplified well beyond what could have ever been imagined a generation previously. So, you know, Marx writes about in Volume 3, you would never know it today from the way the left talks about finance as being parasitic and a drain on capitalism. But actually, the truth is, finance was utterly integral to the early formation and dynamism and competitiveness of capitalism. It's not just something that emerges at a late stage of financialization where the system is decaying or collapsing or whatever. Without finance, no giant corporation. So the development of the credit system made possible, it was a necessary condition for the development of the giant corporation. It was a necessary condition for being able to move capital at very low cost that unified the national market, later the international market, the world market. And it allowed the economy to operate on a much larger scale than ever before. And in doing so, it became more competitive, right? Every single outlet for investment had to massively accelerate the process of concentration and centralization to increase returns, to increase efficiency, or be bought up and merged with a company with a firm that was doing that. Mm-hmm. So really the early development of the banking system and the financial system in the US was a critical condition for the development of corporate capitalism itself.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, the book really starts in chapter two by looking at the classical period of finance capital. And so, you know, following Hilferding, we define finance capital as just an organizational fusion between financial institutions on the one hand and industrial corporations on the other. So finance capital is not, you know, financial capital. This is a specific class form, right, based on a fusion between finance and industry. And this, of course, was made possible by the role that investment banks played in forming, right, corporations and mobilizing the capital and allocating the credit necessary for the formation of corporations in the very first instance, right? So from the very beginning, as Steve was mentioned, you know, corporate capitalism in the United States was financialized, right? And it was based around this kind of form of finance capital. Now, you know, for Hilferding and for us, finance capital is not about the micromanaging by financial firms and banks, investment banks, et cetera, of the, you know, industrial managers. You know, the functioning capitalists inside industrial firms still, of course, have a degree of autonomy. They're not answering on a second by second basis to the actions of, you know, financially, of the financiers which controlled interlocking boards of directorate during the period. But there is a layer of power above the finance, above the industrial firm, that is exercising a degree of control over the, you know, operations of industrial capitalists. And so we see that, that, you know, in our mind, the post-2008 crisis brings back a different form, a new form of finance capital, reminiscent in some respects, right, of the classical period of finance that that Steve was talking about, with the formation of the banking system and the formation of a national form of money, and et cetera, et cetera.
So in terms of your question about finance and industry, though, I forgot to
industry part. Yeah.
Yeah. So financial capital, you know, is defined by Marx as M to M prime, right? Anybody here who's read Marx knows about this M prime stuff. You start with money and you end up with more money, right? You circulate money and you get back money with interest, right? So you end up with profit. You end up with interest that is on top of the money that you circulated. Industrial capital is M to C to M prime in Marx's terms, which means that the industrial capitalist starts with the money, mm-hmm. purchases commodities, labor power, and the means of production. Labor power and the means of production produce a commodity, which is then sold for more money. So the industrial capitalist is the circuit that is going through the production process. The financial capital is where that initial M comes from, and also where part of the surplus that's produced through the production process is redistributed to finance after production takes place. So money capital is M to M prime. Industrial capital is MCM prime. Mm-hmm. And finance capital, which is kind of an unfortunate term, but it's defined by Hilferding as the fusion of financial and industrial capital. And so what's interesting about the formation of the corporation is that you get the operation of industry by money capital. You get money capitalists, shareholders, all of a sudden, all ownership and control over the means of production doesn't take the form any longer of direct ownership of fixed assets like factories and mm-hmm. machines. Instead, ownership is completely organized around tradable shares. So you move from personal ownership to impersonal ownership. And those shares are basically a form of money. So you have the whole operation of industry itself becomes merged with and organized around a form of money capital, basically.
Mm-hmm. And there's a long-term interconnection here, right, between finance and industry. I mean, part of the way, as Steve was mentioning, that finance is able to obtain, you know, this kind of controlling influence over industry, you know, associated with the fusion of financial and industrial capital, is by owning and controlling the shares that industrial capitalists issue. And this is, of course, done as a result of the fact that the investment banks bringing these firms public are just basically holding on to the shares that they're issuing. But also, critically as well, is that these financial firms hold the credit and the debt of these industrial firms. And, you know, this is a long-term relationship. So, which means that the financial firms have a long-term interest in the viability and the health of these industrial corporations. And that leads them to take a more active interest in the organization and the operation of these firms, because their own profitability depends on it to a great extent. And we see the same thing, in a sense, playing out today with the rise of the asset management firms and the remarkable concentration of ownership power that they've obtained since 2008.
You guys talk about that, how they have their hand in so many companies, a little bit of ownership here and there. I forget how many companies that you said these guys have their hand in, but it was fascinating to read that. I do want to get to the super chat question, the serious one. There's two. They're both serious, let's be honest. From JB. Thank you very much, JB. What are your guests' thoughts on the U.S. going off gold standard in conjunction with emergence of petrodollar via an aggressive U.S. foreign policy under Nixon, the Nixon presidency, and the ones that followed?
Well, go ahead.
You want to start, Steve, and I'll jump in, or vice versa?
You go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, a few things here. We talk about the Bretton Woods system and the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in 71 or 73 under Nixon. And, you know, it's plays a certain role in the book. But, you know, very briefly, I think one has to first off understand that the Bretton Woods system, which emerges in 1944, is technically, a gold standard, but it's a quasi gold standard at best. And gold was never served as a disciplinary mechanism within the system. And so there is always an enormous capacity for national banking systems to basically, you know, create the credit necessary to spur growth and development. And there wasn't the same constraints that had taken place within accumulation under the classical gold standard, which was, you know, by the early 1930s, completely dead in the water. So, you know, the period from 1944 to 1971, the Bretton Woods system, there was a dollar gold peg and everyone else was linked to dollars, right? So it was an indirect relationship to gold for everyone else but the U.S. economy, but the U.S. economy wasn't effectively constrained by gold for any real way. And so, you know, the gold standard really never functioned as a typical gold. The post-war gold standard never really functioned as a typical gold standard. And the moment that the U.S. faced, you know, irresolvable constraints on that system, they abandoned the dollar gold link, giving rise to a different kind of international monetary regime, which was based around the U.S. dollar and, you know, associated with that as petrodollars, et cetera. And the one thing is that, you know, abandoning the gold link expanded the state's capacity to issue credit and deepened the U.S. state's role within the international financial system, and made essentially the Federal Reserve, right, the de facto world central bank. And the Federal Reserve, you know, through the, you know, the post-1970s period, has increasingly taken on the responsibilities of a central bank. And, you know, so the abandonment of the dollar gold link in 1971 certainly led to a more powerful and active Federal Reserve, but I wouldn't want to overextend that linkage. There was, beyond the dollar gold link, other components of the Bretton Woods system that collapsed in the 1970s, which were equally, if not more, important. The movement towards floating exchange rates associated with this, the collapse of capital controls are also very important in this trajectory as well.
Can you guys explain capital controls real quick?
Go ahead, Scott.
You want me to... Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. So capital controls are really just very simply just controls on the movement of investment internationally. So limitations and costs imposed on capital for moving investment across borders. And, you know, so they're basically a tool in the Bretton Woods system. They were a tool that was designed to support the internationalization of capital by allowing states, national states, a certain space, a certain autonomy to be able to implement fiscal policies that would support the legitimacy of markets and support the legitimacy of global capitalism. So capital controls were kind of a foundational part of the Bretton Woods system, and they were intended to support globalization at that particular stage. But one thing I wanted to add to what Scott was just saying, or emphasize about what Scott was just saying, which is, I think, important, is that we in the book, one of the things we try to do is to trace how the state evolved and changed in relation to the development of global capitalism. So the internationalization of capital, the globalization of capital, part and parcel of that was the rise within the state, the empowerment within the American state of the central bank, and the insulation of the central bank from democratic pressures and accountability. And that's, those things went together. Part of the reason why the Federal Reserve was able to become the seat of power within the state, the dominant seat of power within the state, is precisely because it was insulated from democratic pressures, and that allowed it to be able to do things that otherwise it wouldn't have been able to do. And that has supported the erosion and the de-democratization of the American state itself. No matter which party wins the election in the fall, we would expect that the Federal Reserve will do basically the same things. At least that's what capital expects, and that's why they have an independent central bank as such a priority. And so the abandonment of the Bretton Woods system also meant that, because of the adoption of floating exchange rates, like Scott was just saying, also meant that new forms of international cooperation became necessary between central banks. And it meant that the American empire played a very important role in global capitalism, because it facilitated that coordination across different central banks around the world to be able to undertake in a coordinated fashion the interventions necessary to maintain monetary stability. Because, you know, if you're circulating value across borders, you need those exchange rates to be relatively stable, as stable as possible anyway. And so that means you need coordination among central banks. So you have the development of more authoritarian state forms all across the advanced capitalist world as part of what globalization is about.
Mm-hmm. And on top of that, if I could just add one more thing, because I think it's important for understanding the role that finance plays in contemporary capitalism. With the move to floating exchange rates and the collapse of, you know, currency par values that were established with the post-war monetary system, you have an increased role for finance in the overall accumulation process. And this is, of course, you know, the world of derivatives. If currencies are continuously fluctuating, there's, you know, states can manage those by, you know, maintaining a low inflation policy regime, right, to stabilize the value of the currency. States can manage those by accumulating foreign exchange reserves, U.S. dollars, so that they can intervene in foreign exchange markets and moderate imbalances between supply and demand and stabilize their currency. But those two mechanisms of state control only go so far. What happens with a floating exchange rate system when you essentially privatize exchange rate risk, right, is you support the development of, you know, markets for the management of risk, which are not just speculative casinos, but are functional to accumulation, right? So, you know, these derivative markets, which are, you know, financial derivatives explode in the early 1970s, precisely because with the international movement of capital, firms need to manage exchange rate and interest rate risk in an increasingly volatile global capitalism in order to make a profit. Because, of course, you know, small shifts in currency value or interest rates can wipe out profitability. And, of course, that's not conducive to a global capitalism. So these financial instruments, therefore, come to take a much more prominent role in the organization of accumulation within globalization. And really, financialization kind of underpins and is the opposite side or the same side of the coin that globalization is.
So even the villains, even the worst villains, derivatives are actually not parasitic on capitalism. They're actually an essential component of globalization and how corporations manage risk.
Right.
There's a follow-up question JB had. Was Bretton Woods system better described as a, quote, pool of currencies plus gold, much like what BRICS is attempting to create outside the U.S. dollar?
Interesting way of putting it.
Yeah. I would say, if I'm understanding the question correctly, I would say not so much, because the Bretton Woods system was deeply hierarchical, mm-hmm. right? It was organized around the U.S. dollar as the central intervention currency. Mm-hmm. And not only was it organized that way, it functioned that way, especially after 1958, when capital control, when the movement of capital resumed for trade purposes, right? So it was extremely hierarchical in a way that the BRICS system isn't. And it was from the very beginning organized around the U.S. dollar, and the centrality of the U.S. dollar therefore took shape not in 1971, but all the way back in 1944. And it was on the basis of the monetary system that had developed in the post-war period that you get a floating exchange dollar system in the 1970s.
So this is the American empire, right? That's really what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
This is the structure of the American empire.
Speaking of the empire, can you talk about the role that the military-industrial complex plays in the rise of finance capital post the 29 crash?
Yeah, this is such a great question, because it really does draw into question or challenge the usual framing of the so-called Keynesian era from, you know, the 1930s until 1970s as being one of peace and stability and harmony and good capitalism led by the good manufacturing firms. Yeah. Right. I mean, that is really kind of one of the central things we're trying to take on here, is this idea that, like, Keynesianism was this wonderful, good capitalism led by good manufacturing companies. And now it's the bad capitalism led by the bad financial companies. And so workers should form an alliance with the industrial capitalists, that is to say their bosses, against the evil financiers who are the really bad capitalists, the real exploiters. Right. That's really what we're trying to take on. And the question about the military industrial complex brings us right to that point, because Basically, the one of the core foundations of the global competitiveness of American multinational corporations was the military-industrial complex. All the leading capital-intensive manufacturing firms were closely linked to the military-industrial complex, which was basically a huge engine of state industrial policy and research and development.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that bore the brunt of especially basic research and development costs, you know, technologies that didn't have any immediate market applicability, but would be the foundation of future new product lines and so on.
Touchscreens.
Yeah, touchscreens. I mean, literally, you can look at your iPhone, basically every single component of your iPhone.
GPS.
Yeah, absolutely. Siri, I forget what the acronym stands for, but Siri is actually an acronym developed by the military to describe that technology. Oh, wow. But yeah, so the military-industrial complex, you know, was linked with the dominant multinational corporations who, you know, appropriated those technologies as private property, turned them into product lines, and then sold them competitively. So the military-industrial complex was not incidental to the global competitiveness of American multinationals. It was absolutely foundational to it, their emergence as the leading corporations in the world.
Yeah. So, like, you know, as Steve mentioned a while back, you know, we see that there's four kind of phases of financialization. We trace the four periods of financialization from, you know, the 1800s on, the classical finance period, the managerial period, the neoliberal period, and the new finance capital period. And what you see during the managerial period, of course, is the hegemony of centralized industrial corporations. But these corporations are increasingly financialized themselves, right? Mm-hmm. They're internalizing this M2M logic as, like, the general managers within these companies are kind of managing a pool of capital and choosing to invest in particular branches of production, et cetera, et cetera. And so the foundation for the managerial period, we argue, was like the fragmentation of equity holdings and the breaking up of the, you know, the House of Morgan and the investment banks, the Glass-Steagall Acts and the Banking Acts of 1933 and 1935. It was the ability for industrial corporations to finance, secondly, investment through retained earnings. And then third, the significance of state investment in these industrial firms through the military-industrial complex, right, which emerged from the Second World War, was a key pillar of this kind of managerial period industrial hegemony. So the military industrial complex does play, you know, a central part in that period and thus in the story.
So in other words, you can't separate the good Keynesian capitalism from the slaughter of the Vietnamese, right? It's all part of the same system. One is completely interconnected with the other.
And do you think that interconnection looks any different now?
Well, yeah, and not in the sense that the military-industrial complex has been restructured, and it looks a lot more like a private equity operation now, basically, where you have a model that's more based on developing, you know, individual technologies into individual firms, which then get bought up by the big firms in a competitive market way. So it's a little bit of a different structure, but it's still a major support for American multinationals for sure. But what we argue is that the economic apparatus of the state, that is to say, if we assume that you know, one part of the state's functioning is its integration with the economy, its direct management, its direct organic interconnection with accumulation. We could call that the economic apparatus of the state. Mm-hmm. That has been restructured distinctively across each of these periods that we were describing. So yes, the military-industrial complex is still crucially important for the competitiveness of American industrial firms, but it's not the leading element of the economic apparatus since the neoliberal period. Where is policy being set? Where is the most important macroeconomic policy being made? It's the Federal Reserve, it's the central bank, right? It's the parts of the state that correspond to finance. Mm-hmm. And that's not just accidental. The restructuring of the economy itself, as finance became more powerful and more important within the economy, also meant that those components of the state that are most closely linked with the financial system rose within the hierarchy of state apparatuses, right? Rose within the state complex itself. So the parts of the state that are most closely integrated with finance are now the center of state power, and they have become, you know, thoroughly insulated from democratic input, resulting in what we call the neoliberal authoritarian state. So the rise of finance also part and parcel of that was the restructuring of the state and the development of a particularly authoritarian state, the hollowing out of democracy and all the rest of it.
You know, we're coming up on the end of an hour. I want to thank you guys for hanging out with us again. If what you guys hear is interesting and you want to know more, wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there's a link in the description to the book, The Fall and Rise of American Finance. The book discusses the phenomenon of too big to fail, institutions and the moral hazard they pose to the economy. We live in a world where government bailouts socialize corporate financial risk, yet privatize profits. Can we ever truly rein in the finance industry?
This is such an important question. I don't know how much time we have, but we need another hour.
As much time as you need. As much time as you need.
Because honestly, like, this is a critical question, and it gets at some of the so many of the different key points we're trying to raise. First is this question of the relationship between the state and the financial system today. Mm-hmm. And basically what we argue, what we show in the book, is that the financial system in its current form is basically completely embedded with, integrated with state power, especially the Federal Reserve. So the financial system in its current form is effectively fused with the power of the state. So there is absolutely no justification for the financial system to be run as a private for-profit concern. It should be run as a public utility, and it already is completely fused with, ensconced by state power. That's the first point. The second point is about the power, the political power of financiers. And there, I think it's important to, you know, our argument in this regard is that, you know, this it's very often discussed that, you know, Robert Brenner and other Marxists especially often point to the 2008 bailouts as being an example of the Wall Street fat cats, you know, getting their buddy Hank Paulson to, you know, give them blank checks. But in reality, what happened, as we show in the book, was basically the state acting in a way that was necessary to shore up the fundamentals of the financial system, to restore the stability of the financial system by supporting in an unlimited fashion the key institutions and assets that underpin that system. That is to say, basically to nationalize the most important aspects of the financial system, to integrate them with state power in a way that was intended to signal effectively forevermore the state was behind the financial system in its current organizational form to an unlimited extent. And so the difference institutionally and materially between the power of the state and that and the institutions and assets that comprise the most important parts of the financial system is completely blurred, right? So it's not so much about the fat cats taking over the state, instrumentalizing it, and forcing it, you know, pilfering state coffers, as Robert Brenner calls escalating plunder. It's actually a relatively autonomous Federal Reserve acting out of the long-term general interest of the capitalist system as a whole and doing the things necessary to prevent the financial system from collapsing. And so, you know, framing this, I think, as escalating plunder, as being a case of the financial system ripping off the state, ripping off the public, it misunderstands the challenge that we face in terms of what it means to take on finance. Like, we don't just have to, like, out lobby them, right? We actually have a state that is organized in its deepest DNA around acting this way. So it's not just about beating the financial lobbyists so that we can have, you know, more democratic space for our own policies or our own approach to bailing out, you know, homeowners and not just financiers. We actually have to take on the organizational structure of the state in a much deeper and more fundamental way and to restructure that state power in a way that is conducive to, hopefully, at some point, a socialist transition where the public controls investment and not Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really just to hit this point home a bit more. It's critical to understand that what happened in 2008 was not about, you know, the state just kind of, you know, bailing out the banking system because, you know, they're just best friends and aligned politically, etc. Mm-hmm. It was really about supporting the financial system, right? Which relied on certain assets, mortgage-backed securities, right, to generate credit. And the market-based financial system, which had developed the neoliberal period, which was about like a, you know, a long chain of credit intermediation. Credit was not just provided by banks to corporations or banks to consumers. The process of generating credit was now restructured and took shape through a large number of corporations, and also through this the mortgage market. Like, that new system of credit intermediation collapsed, fell on its face. And, you know, quantitative easing especially, and all the backstops the state introduced, were about kind of supporting and bailing out that system and making that system more resilient, about rebuilding the system of market-based finance and incorporating it ever more into state power, in the same way that the state bailed out the financial system in the 1930s and incorporated it in, you know, to state power. This was a dramatic extension of state power, FDIC in the 1930s, and the new repo provisions following the 2008 financial crisis are very similar, insofar as both are aimed at making that, you know, credit system that the banking system or the shadow banking system operates, depending on what period you're looking at, just more functional and resilient. And in the process of supporting this system, in 2008 and afterwards, the state had to pick all types of winners and losers, right? Mm-hmm. And on top of that, it dramatically extended regulation over the banking system, right? Dodd-Frank was not an insignificant piece of legislation. At least the banks didn't think so. They hated it, right? And Basel III also imposed serious constraints on the banking system. So, you know, to see this in terms of just political capitalism, I think is to miss all of these points and to really look past the state's relative autonomy. And as long as the state is relatively autonomous, right? It has the capacity, right? To act in the general interests of finance, and that in fact poses, as Steve was saying, constraints, right, that we have to be sober about.
Yeah, they kind of have the best of both worlds, capitalists do right now. They have the unlimited support of the state for the financial system, and they also have this firewall whereby the profits of that are made by financial investment are privatized, but also control over investment is firmly locked in private hands. So they have complete public support for the financial system, total state support for the financial system, and a firewall called the difference between public and private that makes sure that the capitalist class and the interests of profitability and competitiveness are the criteria that determine where investment goes. Mm-hmm. So they have a public system with a capitalist logic. And I think that that's why I would frame the task of socialism, the task of socialist strategy, as being thinking about how to overcome that autonomy, that relative autonomy between the public and the private, take direct public control over the financial system, and start thinking about how we can allocate investment on the basis of criteria other than profit maximization. That is to say, in a word, economic planning, democratic economic planning. And I think whether people like it or not, that's got to be an essential component, not just of socialist strategy, because I'm a utopian dreamer and I want, you know, a wonderful socialist society, but because if we're going to survive the climate crisis, that's got to be a piece of it. And it's really going to come down to a question of whether we make it. And if we are going to make it, it's going to involve some kind of economic planning. And if it's going to be some kind of economic planning, the question is, what kind? Is it going to be a democratic economic planning system, or is it going to be some kind of nightmarish corporatist arrangement designed to support corporate profitability, hand over valuable intellectual property to multinational corporations to sell competitively on the world market, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the task of socialists is to build the forces to make sure that we can, first of all, have the economic restructuring that we need to survive the climate crisis. And second of all, to compel those structures to not just be subcontracted out to multinationals to support their profits, but democratic, meaningfully democratic institutions, which ensure that investment is responsive to public and ecological need.
Part of this project is kind of understanding how finance works and the role of finance within accumulation, right? And really, we wrote the book to be an accessible introduction to the financial system and the changing institutional forms that the financial system takes. And we really tried to write it in a way that that's accessible to people that don't have a background in the financial system.
So
they can understand what market-based finance is today, right? Because it's really important. And they can understand the power of banking and the potentialities of, like, you know, democratic control over investment in banking. But that requires understanding the financial system and breaking down, right, some of the, you know, the more complicated components. So that was kind of like a motivating force for writing the book, really.
Well, again, I think you guys did a great job on that. We have a question. They don't have money for a super chat. That's fine. We appreciate you watching anyway. By we, I mean me. But does the book get into control fraud, or is it more focused on the structural implications of finance capitalism?
It's more focused on the institutional and structural features of finance capital. Yeah. And so we, like Scott was saying, I mean, really what the book tries to do is show in very accessible and non-technical terms how the financial system has evolved and changed institutionally, you know, from the days of J.P. Morgan, the robber baron J.P. Morgan, all the way until the rise of BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard in the current period. And to trace that, how that's connected to the changes in the state, and the formation of the American empire.
And in closing, we asked this question of all of our guests. I don't remember how it got started, but it's been going on for a while now.
And I'm scared.
It's bigger than me.
I'm afraid.
You should be, and that's what she said. What are the panel's thoughts on neoliberal hoes versus free market hoes? Loyal, not loyal.
That's a really good question. And I have to say, on that particular question, I can say the neoliberal hoes are the same as the free market hoes from my analytical perspective.
As a
professor of economics, I feel I'm very qualified to pronounce on this. And
Scott, do you want to?
No, I think Steve is absolutely correct on this issue.
A real exception to the norm.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Free market or neoliberal hoes. Loyalty is not a part of their makeup. Thank you guys so much for watching and checking everything out. If you're new here, please, on your way out, hit like, hit subscribe. We will be going into I will be going to the champagne room. These gentlemen will probably be going to sleep because it's a little bit later in the evening where they are. Thank you guys also for working around. There was a problem with our schedule at first. I had the wrong day, and you guys made it happen anyway. So that's very huge from the bottom of my black heart, figuratively and literally. Thank you so much for making this happen. If you guys want to hang out with me in the champagne room watching, or listening later on Apple Podcasts, it's as simple as subscribing on Apple. You can become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. You can have access to champagne rooms past and present. Join us for movie nights and so much more. You just make sure that we can stay on the air. It's a struggle, guys. But thank you guys again for hanging out with us.
Oh, thank you too. Really,
thank you so much,
It's really nice to be here and to have the chance to have this chat. So I really appreciate you having us on.
Hey, I appreciate the book. And can we give a big, fat, massive shout out to the guy that put this show together, to Ray Reed? Shout out to Ray Reed. Pascal and I will be doing a panel with his dad in a few months in DC. I'll have more details on that later. But until then, we are out.